Hello, America, and welcome to yet another episode of Apples to Donuts. I'm Jeff Wambolt, and you all know Dave Klemisch. How you doing today, Dave?
Kind of a deep thinking kind of mood today, Jeff.
Wow, that's certainly different than normal. What's on your mind?
Well, somebody I know here in town is taking speech 101 at the local college, and she was kind of complaining about it, and she was telling me how wasteful it seems to have to take a class, a speech class, to do something that most every single person does every day, like speak.
Mm-hmm.
So according to this person I know, we all know how to talk. We all know how to speak. So why do I have to get up in front of a bunch of people to give a speech about something I researched when anybody can go do the research themselves? I mean, we've got the internet. So That's got me in a deep thinking sort of mood.
Well, how do you answer that, Dave? I mean, nothing could be further from the truth in my mind. The ability to give a speech, an effective speech, or simply to communicate effectively can help obtain, you know, a job, or can lead to a promotion at work. And, you know, in a general sense, it can help in all sorts of, you know, like relationships, you know, with your spouse or children, or even a crowd of people if you happen to be in that situation.
We're on the same page. And I told her something like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she's a college freshman, but she was more interested in the money, the payday, the, the immediate gratification, if you will.
Like, sure.
So I got to ask you, Jeff, you're a person, you've given speeches, you've talked to big groups of people, small groups of people. Have you ever looked up how much people make for giving speeches?
For giving speeches? I'm not sure about that. I do know, though, Dave, that you can hire a speechwriter for, you know, like for a best man speech, for example, or a retirement speech, or, you know, for work sometimes, a work speech for something, I think it's around $100.
$100? You gave a pretty good speech when your son got married. You didn't spend $100 on a speech.
No, I wrote that one myself.
Yeah, that was good. But no, I had no idea. I didn't know you could buy a speech for $100. $100, somebody writes a speech. How about to give a speech? You ever been paid? You're a speaker. You ever been paid tons of money for giving a speech?
Tons of money? What do you call tons of money?
I don't know. 20 grand?
Oh, man, no. No. That's above my earning potential. Well, at least for now, Dave. At least for now. Yeah, you never know. I think that kind of fee is earned more, you know, in line with what, let's say, a modestly famous book author might get. Or, you know, I know of some contestants that were on reality shows like The Bachelor other reality shows like that.
So that's $20,000. How about $50,000?
So 50 grand, huh? Why not 100 grand? Well, for a speech, that would be nice, actually. That'd be a lot of money. That's more in the range of maybe some halfway famous, you know, former governors. I've heard of giving speeches, or a former senator, maybe even a famous general might get that. Probably, you know, some sports stars like, you know, a John Elway or some other famous quarterbacks, 100,000 maybe. Maybe someone like Clint Eastwood, after all his years and experience, I don't know, for the right cause could put, you know, maybe he could pull in about $500,000.
Oh, okay. So now for $500,000, I know that's in the range of Aerosmith guys. Steven Tyler, he's in the range of $500,000 to $1 million for giving a speech. Or LeBron James, he's $500,000 to $1 million.
Wow. I remember President Reagan back in the day, you know, went on tour shortly after leaving office, earning something like $2 million on a speaking tour through Japan. And that was, I believe, back in the late 80s, in like 1989, something like that.
So now we're talking some serious money, Jeff. 1.5 to 2 mil. Now, that's the kind of speaking fees recent ex-presidents have been commanding. But there's only a handful of ex-U.S. presidents. So, yeah, they're not quite one of a kind, but they're certainly more rare than a retired NFL quarterback or some NBA star. So I get the higher fee for presidents because there's just not as many of them. But that's for like for giving a real speech, a 30-minute talk, a 45-minute talk. That's good money for sure. How about, I don't know, how about for a short speech? What kind of money could somebody make for a short speech, Jeff? Like, I don't know, maybe 6 minutes.
Six minutes. I don't know. I'd hardly call that a speech, though. That's more like a talk. I don't know. I wouldn't call it a speech. Fair. But, you know, if somebody got paid serious money, like what you're talking about for a 6 minute speech, well, there would have to be something important on the line. I mean, very important. Maybe something on a national scale, global. I mean, the person giving the speech would have to be even, I'd say, more rare, more sought after than the five people in the ex-president's club. I would have to say it would have to be somebody, you know, very rare, or somebody with strong character, like Mother Teresa comes to mind, maybe.
Okay.
Impeccable credentials, right? She has to make serious money for a short speech like that.
So I'm talking $20 million for a six-minute speech. Actually, this was in 1969. So with inflation, that's 52 years. That'd be about $140 million in today's money.
$140 million for a six-minute speech. Dave, whoever it is, and I know you're going to tell me, well, that person could certainly, I would say, provide some good motivation for your college student friend, right, who you said it was her freshman speech class, right? Mm-hmm. She wasn't sure about taking the class. So, I don't know. Who was it, Dave? Somebody global? Was it Mother Teresa? It had to be somebody like somebody like that, somebody big, one of a kind.
Mr. Rogers.
Mr. Rogers. All right. Fred Rogers.
The one and only. I mean, he was a big part of my neighborhood and yours and the whole country's neighborhood until he died in 2003 from pancreatic cancer.
Mr. Rogers, the famous children's TV host, earned, you're saying, $20 million in 1969 for a six-minute speech.
He did indeed.
Mm.
So at the time, President Nixon was proposing to cut $20 million from the budget of PBS, the public broadcast station. And it was PBS was this brand new idea, came out of the whole 60s ideas, newly budgeted. And I got to say, a cut of $20 million at the time, mm-hmm. it would have essentially killed the whole idea of public TV. And it likely would have killed Mr. Rogers' neighborhood TV show.
So what, Mr. Rogers was invited to speak before Congress?
He was indeed.
Well, we all knew him as this kind, caring person, Dave. What was he doing in a place like Congress?
The opposite, maybe. Mm-hmm. Mr. Rogers might not have liked the environment, but his presence was needed at the hearing. It was a theme Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, had for his whole life. When you see something you don't like, try to fix it.
Mm. And that's how he got his start in TV, isn't it? The whole medium of television was new back in his time, you know, in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
It was essentially the social media of the day, if you will. And the first time he happened to see some children's programming on TV, I think he was in college at the time. He just absolutely hated it.
I didn't know that. What was it? What do you see that first time?
Well, it was a plain old slapstick TV show. You know the kind, you know, from when we were kids. And it was for kids. It was a kids show showing people getting hit in the face with pies, right? That was typical back then. It was funny enough, mm-hmm. I suppose, for its time. But certainly, not what he wanted kids in our country to be exposed to on a regular basis.
So Fred Rogers sees something he doesn't like, the pie in the face kids TV show.
Mm-hmm.
So what did he try to do to fix it?
Well, he started his own TV show. In 1955, just 4 years after graduating from college, he started his own show, and he went off to New York to work in TV. First, just a couple of years there. Then he came back home to Pittsburgh, where he's from, to help develop the Children's Corner. That's what the name of the show was mm-hmm. called. It was the precursor to the show he started 13 years later in 1968.
That was Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So then in 1969, when Mr. Rogers was testifying before Congress, his show, the Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood show, that had been a national presence for like only a year. But Fred Rogers had been working in the field of childhood development for almost 20 years at the time. He'd actually teamed up with his old grad school professor, Dr. Margaret McFarland. And she was this renowned child psychologist. She was just impressive in her field. So Mr. Rogers hires his old professor to be a consultant on his new TV show. He wanted to make sure the scripts for the show were firmly grounded in a healthy child development theory.
So it's 1969, and Mr. Rogers is in front of the Senate subcommittee to discuss the $20 million budget for PBS. So what did he talk about? I mean, you know, what did he say? How public TV is good for kids, how it needs to be equitable, how it needed more funding, you know, that type of thing?
That's what I thought he talked about. You know,
mm-hmm.
at first that's what I thought about, the equal funding, the quality TV, all that. But Fred Rogers was called to testify in front of this very tough, this very bombastic, this very ornery senator, John Pastore of Rhode Island. He interrupted Mr. Rogers a bunch of times. He waved his hands. He pointed his finger. All that stuff. That
mm-hmm.
there'd been 2 days of testimony on this subject of funding before Mr. Rogers showed up. So the senator Pastore, He was so annoyed with people just reading their prepared testimony.
I get that. In a way, meetings can be so boring, right? Testimony can be boring. There's no feeling, no emotion. People just reading, usually in a monotone voice, blah, 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 blah. I've been there. The words may be right or they are right, but there's just no pizzazz.
I am passionate about this subject. Something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, because
it's written up. Bueller, right? We've seen shows like that. We know people like that. I've had teachers like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Chemistry. Oh, side point. I there's a college sophomore I know who's getting good grades. So I ask him, how are you getting good grades? He said, oh, it's because I'm taking these easy fun classes like organic chemistry. I was like, who are you?
Wow.
In the Senate subcommittee, Mr. Rogers shows up and he's got his 10 minutes of prepared statements ready to be read into the record, just like everybody else. And then the senator declares, like right before Fred Rogers walks in, he says, I am so tired of all these prepared comments. No more reading a script. I don't want to hear any more reading. I want to hear what people really think.
So just like that, Mr. Rogers isn't able to read his prepared speech.
Just like that.
Or his statement. Yep, just like that. Yep. Huh? He probably had all the right words, I'm assuming, because it was written down. And instead, what? He talks from the heart. He talks about feelings.
Yeah. Yeah. And he nails it. He even kept his calm. He kept the mood that he wanted for himself in spite of these really rude comments from the senator. Mr. Rogers, he referred to the 10 minutes of prepared testimony that he isn't going to be able to read. And the senator says in this really snarky tone, would it make you happy if you read it?
You know, Dave, I've got the clip of the testimony online here. Let's listen real quick to this opening exchange between these two people.
Okay, good idea.
This is a philosophical statement and would take about 10 minutes to read, so I'll not do that. One of the first things that a child learns in a healthy family is trust. And I trust what you have said that you will read this. It's very important to me. I care deeply about children. My first children...
Would it make you happy if you read it?
I'd just like to talk about it, if it's all right. Sir.
Did you notice, Jeff? Did you hear the tone in the senator's voice? That just disrespectful, condescending, like he's just bothered by having to listen to this person's testimony.
Mm-hmm. But to be fair, Mr. Rogers probably wasn't famous yet like he is today. His show, had only been out maybe for a year or so. So, yeah, lots of young kids and parents knew who he was, but probably not the senator yet.
True. This was a 6-minute speech. Towards the end, at about, I guess, 4 or 5 minutes, Senator Pastore was moved, even saying, I'm supposed to be a pretty tough guy. And this is the first time I've had goosebumps for the past 2 days.
Well, I'm supposed to be a pretty tough guy, and this is the first time I've had goosebumps for the last 2 days.
Good. So it resonated, didn't it? Even to a stone-cold tough guy, strong words, effective words.
Mm-hmm. At the end, Mr. Rogers, and this is not from script. This is just from his mind because he can't read the script. He closes with the lyrics from his song, What do you do with the mad that you feel? When you feel so mad that you could bite. And the senator's moved. This, like you said, this toughest nails guy, former governor of Rhode Island, the first Italian-American elected to the Senate, who waves his arms and points fingers and he's rude. And listen to how he responds to Fred Rogers' 6-minute speech. Not about policy. It's not about funding, but about the legitimacy of feelings and the truth that we always have options. Listen to the effect of Mr. Rogers' words, Jeff, on the senator. Can you dial back to that video clip to hear the words at the end? It's about the 6-minute mark.
Okay, here we go.
I can stop when I want to, can stop when I wish, can stop anytime. And what a good feeling to feel like this and know that the feeling is really mine. Know that there's something deep inside that helps us become what we can. For a girl can be someday a lady, and a boy can be someday a man.
I think it's wonderful. I think it's wonderful. Looks like you just earned the $20 million.
$20 million? looks like you just earned $20 million. That's what Senator Pastore just said. And you know what? Mr. Fred Rogers, probably, Dave, probably, I'm going to guess, didn't get one penny of that money personally. Not one cent for, what, saving an industry. Dave, that was one impressive speech. And the reason it worked, I think, Dave, is it was truthful. It was heartfelt. This is one of those acts, one of those moments in life that can alter history. When we come back, we'll continue this discussion about the impact this 143-pound mountain of a man had on, well, I'd say all of us. We'll be right back.
Coffee, Hip Hop, and Mental Health is a traveling support group with a mission to normalize therapy. Working with licensed and certified therapists, Coffee, Hip Hop, and Mental Health provides safe spaces and programs to further the mental health conversation and seeks to provide a platform for people to share their story. Go to www.chhamh.com, as in Coffee, Hip Hop, and Mental Health, to learn more about this wonderful organization, Coffee, Hip Hop, and Mental Health, seeking to normalize therapy.
Welcome back, Jeff. When we left for commercial break, you had mentioned Fred Rogers weighed 143 pounds. Not a very large man. I mean, not physically. But you described him as a mountain of a man, which, yeah, I agree with. So it's funny, but I read somewhere that Mr. Rogers was very particular about his weight. He always wanted to be at exactly 143 pounds. It meant a lot to him.
In what way?
Well, each number represents the number of letters in the words of a particular phrase. So The number one is I, because there's one number or one letter. The number four is love. And the number three with three letters is you. I love you.
Wow. Very creative. Very creative. When I was growing up, I didn't know very much about the whole Mr. Rogers neighborhood show. I mean, I would turn it on from time to time, but, you know, it wasn't until I was older that I realized the impact this man had on much of society. This is why I called him a mountain of a man.
Yeah, I agree with you. He was.
Yeah, back in the day, I mean, way back like 50 years when I was in grade school, you know, a lot of kids, mostly older, I would say, out of Mr. Rogers' typical audience range, you know, these older kids would make fun of him. They would make fun because he was so mild-mannered and appeared weak, you know, physically, and he wore those sweaters.
Those sweaters were made by his mom, by the way. Good mom, good
yes,
lady.
Yes, yes. And he would wear those sneakers too, right? Making it a point to change into them right in the beginning, during the opening song, and he talked slowly and very soft. All that made him seem weak to some people, but it was intentional. I'm sure he was like that, you know, in real life too, to some degree. But he presented an image, one that helped kids who needed it, who needed someone like him in their life.
And sure, like the older kids that you talked about, they probably moved on from what the typical five-year-old needed to get out of the show. So these older kids, maybe they moved on to shows at the time like Bonanza or some other shoot 'em up, some Western where the typical male was a gun-carrying cowboy fighting all the time. I get that. What I don't get is making fun or belittlement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember being in a conversation with a bunch of my friends years ago, adults, you know, other parents, and this very topic came up, and some of the guys were acting like little kids and making fun of Mr. Rogers, you know, about being small and soft and meek, not like a quote-unquote real man. And they were carrying on for a few minutes until finally one of them just had enough.
One of the other adults had been what, kind of just listening to the conversation, not joining, but also not countering what the others were saying? What'd he do?
Well, he was someone that appreciated Mr. Rogers. And, well, you know, peer pressure took over for a while. He listened and he smiled, acted like he agreed with the insult of talk, but then just calmly said, like Mr. Rogers would have, he calmly said, "You don't understand because you didn't need him like other kids did. You didn't need him like other kids did."
Powerful words. Did it shut them up?
No, not like it should have. It was a tough group. But you know what? That's okay, because his words have stuck with me for a long time, and it helps me to understand and empathize with other people. And here's why. Like I said before, Dave, I only tune in occasionally to his show, and maybe that was, you know, in part, you know, maybe because I was fortunate enough. I was someone who didn't need Mr. Rogers the way other kids did. I came from a family that was supportive. My parents were there for me always. I was taught right from wrong. And when I reflect, I realize that maybe I didn't need Mr. Rogers' neighborhood because I was living in Mr. Rogers' neighborhood already.
Oh, I get what you're saying, Jeff, about how you were living in Mr. Rogers' neighborhood as a kid, like 15 years after he started his signature TV show. Mm-hmm. Mr. Rogers publicized these six basic needs that a child needs to develop in a healthy way. And there's hundreds, thousands, millions of different ways to raise kids with these six basic necessities. And as a kid, Jeff, it sounds like maybe you had these. Did you have a sense of self-worth and trust?
How do you mean? Can you be more specific?
Well, I don't know. Did you see value not just in yourself, but did you see value in others? Were you taught how to take care of yourself by, I don't know, just even like washing your hands and brushing your teeth? Were there adults who let you help around the house with different projects? Like you hold the flashlight while somebody else fixed something. Did you have adults listen to your stories, laugh at your jokes, even though they had heard them when they were a kid? Did they answer your questions, even though, like, well, why is this? Did you have adults that were just there, like during a storm? Were there adults that were just there letting you know that you were safe?
I did. Yes. I was blessed.
Okay. Well, how about when you were a kid? Did you have a sense of curiosity? And did you couple that with the actual capacity, the ability to look around you and to listen carefully? Kids are curious people about what's happening right now, yesterday, tomorrow.
So did I know that it's all right to wonder? That as a kid there were all sorts of wonderful things? Yes, absolutely. And yes, that is a quote from direct from Mr. Rogers.
Did you have the ability to play, to imagine with other people, with other kids? And did you have the ability to play and imagine kind of when you're alone?
I did. Kind of like the Mr. Rogers quote of, sometimes today, try to give yourself a gift. Try to turn off all the noises around you and give yourself some quiet time. In the silence, allow yourself to think about something, or if possible, try to think about nothing.
To think about nothing? That's good. Like in today's world, maybe that's like driving around with the music off, going outside out the front door or the back patio without your phone, checking the mail without taking your smartphone, just walking down to the mailbox, planning to step away from the whole world that's pushing into our time, into our mind, and instead plan to simply be, to just be in the moment. That's a good Mr. Rogers quote, Jeff.
Well, I may not have gotten it exactly right, but I did get the idea, the tone of the quote. I mean, Mr. Rogers was purposeful in how he did his job, how he made his show, how he interacted with all people, kids, you know, and adults. And then, you know, that group of adults that were speaking in this condescending way about him. You know, I hate when people pick on or, you know, bully others in any way, you know, for whatever reason, whether it's for how they look or for being weaker or meek. I just hate it, Dave.
Yeah, meek. Meek. It's such an interesting word. Like, mm-hmm. People misunderstand meekness for weakness. And nothing could be further from what's true. Some of the most powerful figures in history appeared meek. It can be more powerful than a nuclear thermoblast. I mean, Jesus, Gandhi, mm-hmm. Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King Jr. Maybe Mr. Rogers is in that category, at least in how he was very thoughtful and how he acted and how he spoke and how he handled himself. The Senate subcommittee back in 69, it was kind of like the opposite of how those other adults acted, the ones that were making fun of him, mm-hmm. who didn't even think through their words and actions ahead of time.
You're right. Yeah, those guys were kind of like the senator, the tough-as-nails kind of guy who, you know, gains their strength by belittling others. And then here, there's Mr. Rogers, committed to getting his point across, to maintaining his own mood and, you know, his own sense of calm, because he knew the importance of the moment.
So earlier you had mentioned his sweaters that he always wore, knitted by his mom. I guess maybe you have to wear it if your mom makes them. But I'm sure you've heard the rumors online about why Mr. Rogers always wore those long sleeve sweaters.
I have, actually. Those internet rumors started in the, I think they were in the mid-90s, I remember, then came back around again after Mr. Rogers passed away in 2003. The rumor was that his arms were actually full of tattoos that he earned as an army sniper.
One tattoo for each kill. And both arms, according to what we read online, both arms were covered in tattoos. So what's that mean then, Jeff? How many tattoos, how many sniper kills do you think Mr. Fred Rogers had in his army career?
Well, that's an easy one. I know this. It's zero. Because Mr. Rogers actually was never in the army, was never a sniper. He didn't have tattoos covering his arms. He actually was an ordained minister, a pacifist who built a career focused on child development. And yet, interestingly, those rumors swirled. Like rumors do, they swirled in an attempt to, you know what, make him a tough guy, to tear him down. In reality, Mr. Rogers, you know, he did so well because he built up the people around him, not tore them down.
That's the LeBron James effect, or the Michael Jordan effect, or the John Elway effect, or really anybody who's very talented in this one area. There's lots of people who are talented in one area, but then those people excel to the highest levels because they're able to build up the skills and strengths of the others on their team.
Right, or recruit people to their team who wanted to be around a great organization. I know you know who this is. Mark Cuban, he did that well, or actually does that well still as the owner of the Dallas Mavericks.
Well, I know about LeBron, how he pushes his teammates to follow his lead and perform at higher and higher and higher levels, and how LeBron can attract other talented players to join him on his own team, whether he's on with Miami or Cleveland or L.A. So what did Mark Cuban do?
Well, think about this. The goal of any team anywhere is to win the next game, right? So maybe home teams try to downgrade, in a way, a visiting team's locker room, so to speak, so they don't play as well that night. Inferior quarters, low-quality lights, you know, no Xbox in the locker room, what? Ugly towels for the shower, that type of thing.
No Xbox? Well, I played basketball through high school and a little bit into college, and I can attest to that. As a traveling player visiting, we had some very inferior locker rooms when we were on the road, like just leaky water and, you know, just gross. But to be fair, I think our coach, he returned the favor. When other teams visited our gym, he would return them with the same low-quality facilities in the visiting room.
Well, if the goal was of the team is to win the next game, Mark Cuban realized the goal of the owner, of the, you know, the management, is to build a great team. Build a great team. So to develop their own talent from within and, as necessary, recruit talent from other teams.
Makes sense, yeah. You win tonight's game and develop a championship team that can win for years.
Right. So Cuban applied some team-building strategies that he may have, you know, he may have learned from Mr. Rogers, maybe, perhaps, right? He upgraded the visiting team's locker room. He had the best Xbox games available, big fancy TVs for them to play on. You know, fresh carpeting, big lockers, and even, and get this, small thing, but a big thing, super thick soft towels for the shower.
Oh, sounds lovely. But it also sounds like it doesn't make sense. Like, how does that help Cuban's team win tonight's game? Like, that's all nice, but the other team, they're going to play bad. Oh, yeah, they'll play better. I get it. Yeah, as management, as the owner, Cuban is thinking about next year's team. And the year after that, and the year after that, and the year after that.
And what better marketing than to invest in a locker room where literally every player, or really every employee in the league will see it, will experience what it's like to work for, you know, Mark Cuban at least once or twice a season or so.
And then when it's time for contracts and deciding where somebody wants to play, or really where somebody wants to work, since all NBA players are also employees.
Seems like the Mavericks run a nice organization. I mean, who wouldn't want big TVs, Xbox, good towels? So it seems like Mark Cuban pushes for, or he encourages growth for his employees while, you know, of course, also setting the goal, the ultimate goal, which is winning, right? Winning is really where it's at the pro level. That's really the bottom line here for an NBA team, Dave, is, you know, it's winning.
I'm going to segue here. Have you, Officer Jeff, have you worked with anyone, or you know anyone that's been like that, like a Mark Cuban or a LeBron or a Mr. Rogers, somebody who could build others up, who made their team, who made their organization better by attracting great talent and at the same time growing the skills of those who are already within the organization?
Actually, yes. You know, as much as some government agencies or government-run agencies and probably large corporations too, how they are, well, let's just say sometimes there's not much accountability and follow-through, even though this is, you know, even though it's true much of the time, I do know this one police chief who is proactive. He's one of our suburban police chiefs. He's good. He doesn't wait for problems, Dave. He doesn't wait for those problems to exist. He prevents them.
He stops them from happening. He prevents them. What's he do? How's he do it?
Well, to start with, basically, he listens to everyone from the citizens to the mayor. And, you know, even in his own department, from the third shift officer to the second in command, he welcomes everyone's ideas or thoughts and, you know, and especially criticisms if they're handled properly.
He can take criticism. he encourages criticism. Yeah. That's important.
Yes, as long as it's constructive, you know, constructive criticism, no attacking, no demeaning someone else. Basically, you know, offering advice or possibly a better way of doing something.
Sounds like a very good leader.
Yeah, he is.
So what else does he do or what else does he not do? I mean, he's probably got all sorts of tools in his toolbox.
Oh, for sure. I don't work for him or his department, but I interact a lot with his officers. They love the guy. Anyway, he seems to be the whole package. He's honest and transparent, communicates well. He's basically a true leader, uses humor, gives direction, and he supports and inspires his officers to achieve.
Sounds like those officers are fortunate to have him as a leader because good leaders are hard to come by. I like that word you just said, Jeff, inspire. You said he inspires. Mm-hmm. I think that's very important. Like any leader, in this case, a chief of police, any leader needs to bring out the best in their people, their officers, their team.
He does. In fact, Dave, speaking of the word inspire, every year he sends his top brass, his top supervisors to the Inspire Leadership Conference. It's the same one you and I have attended in the past.
Most years. Mm-hmm. I know I missed the last couple. I heard this year was particularly great.
It was, yeah. COVID sort of got in the way, but well worth the money.
So if anyone's listening gets a chance to attend one of these Inspire seminars or one similar to in your part of the country, I highly recommend it.
I do too. In fact, I still have one of their marketing flyers in my briefcase. So for anyone interested, here's how they describe the seminar. And this is in quotes. Inspire is a premier leadership development experience featuring high caliber national and regional speakers and experts providing inspirational content to elevate your personal and professional leadership journey.
That's a good description. Mm-hmm. It's about leadership. It's about how to be a better leader, a more effective leader.
And inspired to take on the world. The keynote speaker this year was Dan Heath. He I don't know if you know this, Dave, he wrote the book Upstream, mm-hmm. The Quest to Solve Problems Before They Happen.
Sort of like a modern-day Mr. Rogers. Mm-hmm. Take some time now to consider what's important to me so that I can speak and I can act in a way that's consistent with my values. That's Mr. Rogers' way of thinking it, because if I can do that with some sort of consistency, then there's all sorts of problems that aren't happening for me because I've solved them before they even happened.
Yeah, you're pretty spot on there, Dave. In a way, prevention is key, whether in the workplace or, like Mr. Rogers, in a child's life. We should get Dan Heath on the show.
We should. Mm-hmm. Right after Shaquille O'Neal. Still trying to figure out how to make that one happen, Jeff, from back in season one.
Funny. That seems to be a, you know, a standing joke around here. I'll tell you what, just for you, I will call him during the break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hi there. I am Dr. Tracy Dixon Salazar. I'm the executive director of the Lennox-Gastaut Syndrome Foundation, and I'm here with my husband and my daughter.
I love Freddy in the house.
You love Freddy D in the house. I know you do. He gets you when you're having some shakes. Yes.
I had a shake like this.
You have a shake like that, and he lays with you, huh? He licks your hand when you're having a shake?
My daughter Savannah is 28, and she has Lennox-Gastaut Syndrome. She has been fighting it for 26 years. She started having seizures when she was 2, a horrific 26-year journey. Every day at the LGS Foundation, I work with other families who have been through the same thing that we've been through. go to lgsfoundation.org, maybe donate to help us raise money for some incredible research that's coming around the corner that can help children like my daughter, Savannah. Go to lgsfoundation.org to learn more about this disease and about how you can help children and families that are really struggling with this horrible disease, but want to fight back. Thank you.
Welcome back. So, Jeff.
Give it up.
What?
You know what?
Well.
Shaq's line was busy.
So maybe I'll get him next time.
Right. I'll tell you what. Before our podcast ends, I mean, even if it takes years, we will have Shaquille O'Neal on the show.
Fishbowl.
What? What does that mean? Is that your way of swearing at me without actually swearing?
No, I'm just changing subjects. Yes. We'll get Shaquille O'Neal on the show. Shaq, call in.
Okay. All right.
Dan,
all right.
Call in. Absolutely. But I'm changing topics on you.
Okay. Fishbowl. Does that mean anything, or are you just throwing me off?
I wouldn't throw you off. Maybe I would. No, seriously, though. In teaching, when we were talking earlier about Mr. Rogers, this was on my mind. So in teaching, there's this classic activity, in-class activity called the fishbowl. And it can be this really effective technique that allows the teacher to step back from their role at the front of the, being the sage on the stage, and instead allow the students to step in, essentially to take more leadership for, more leadership for their education. So the way you set it up, there's a circle of chairs in the middle of the classroom. All the desks are pushed to the side. And it's those circles, the circle of chairs is designed for the students to have a discussion. And then there's a larger circle of chairs around the outside, kind of designed for those other students to listen and observe.
Well, where's the teacher? Assuming off to the side somewhere, listening and observing the observers? Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay. And usually the students, they know what's coming, so they've got time ahead before the actual discussion to come up with questions. And maybe they're reading a book, you're halfway through a book, you're not quite sure what's happening. But the students can practice the skill of discussing, of taking turns, of making sure everybody has shared something. And when answering, and this is my favorite, it's helpful in the fishbowl activity if you give at least three parts to your answer. So instead of simply saying, yes, I agree, or no, I disagree, it is so much more helpful to the discussion if you say something like, well, it could be this, it could be that, and after thinking about it, I agree, or no, I don't agree.
Those three components in the answer, I'm sure, are good for helping to get the actual discussion going, not just getting the actual answers, right?
Yeah, you're right. And the cool thing about the fishbowl is the goal is less about getting the right answer and more about having that conversation, about listening to other people, about let's just see where this conversation takes us. It's right out of the counseling principle of I can create options for myself. And it's so incredibly similar to the concept you talked about at the Inspire conference, Jeff, with stopping problems before they begin. It's similar to Mr. Rogers' ideas about speaking and acting with a purpose. It's just for fun. It's also how I show people how to have a conversation.
Show?
Yeah, it's what I do in my counseling office. But when somebody says, how was your day? Most common answer, you've got kids. Good. No right. Discussion after that. Or using the principles from the classroom, that the fishbowl activity, when somebody says, how was your day? Instead of just saying good or fine, try to come up with three specific things about your day. Somebody you talked to, something you ate, a moment that you were frustrated or happy or bored or excited.
Hey, Dave.
Yes, Jeff.
How was your day?
You got me. Good. Fine. I did stuff. So. I'll give you. How was my day? I'll give you my three-part answer. Today was an interesting day, Jeff. It started just before my alarm went off. I actually didn't need my alarm today because I woke up to the sound of this annoying woodpecker pecking on my aluminum gutters just outside my bedroom window. That's part one. I just gave you one thing. That lovely woodpecker allowed me to get up 10 minutes early. Part two. Okay, two out of three. So I'm looking for a third one. Morning was good. I got up early, but when I opened my window to shoo away that lovely woodpecker, I actually did see two deer standing in my backyard.
Wow.
Third part. Bam, bam, bam. But it was the beginning of a good day. How was your day, Jeff?
Nice answer. Positive spin. I like it. Mr. Rogers, I had a...
Just being honest.
Right. I actually had a woodpecker issue once. Not so positive. Pecked every morning at 6 a.m.
That is even too early for Woody Woodpecker to show up. So what do you do? How do you get rid of a 6 a.m. woodpecker?
After about a week of that nonsense, really, I taped a bunch of aluminum foil to the gutter.
Aluminum foil fights off woody woodpecker?
Yes. Actually, it worked for me. I taped a bunch of pieces of foil to string and then taped the string to the gutter, and it acted like a windsock.
I suppose that's interesting. I could see that working.
I read it somewhere. They don't like shiny, reflective, you know, items. Anyway, it worked.
I'll have to try that the next time that I, hopefully the woodpecker went away. Didn't your neighbor use that same theme with their very energetic puppy who just kept jumping up on their couch? They had that new couch, so they put the sheets of aluminum foil on the couch and it kept the dog off the couch, at least till they got tired of putting the foil on the couch every time they left the house.
Old Reese, the puppy.
Yes, Reese.
Old Reese, the puppy.
Old Reese, the puppy. Yeah, young Reese, the dog.
Yeah, well, anyway, Reese, the dog. So let's get back to the fishbowl for a minute. The fishbowl activity you were telling us about, Dave, the way you talk about language, about the skill of having a conversation, breaking down, you know, these big ideas into concrete topics, that's also straight out of the thinking of Fred Rogers. He was so aware of the power of words and of vagueness, especially how it relates to the stages of a child's brain development.
What do you mean?
Well, remember the goldfish he had on the set?
Mm-hmm.
You know, speaking of fishbowls. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Hey, yeah, it works.
That was unintentional. He always fed the goldfish during the show. I think it was at the beginning. But he would be singing the Won't You Be My Neighbor song. So, yeah, it was at the beginning, taking off his tennis shoes, moving about the set. And he would take the lid off the fish food and sprinkle some of the food in the water for the fish. But he received some very concerning mail from a particular child listener about this.
And you and I know Mr. Rogers read and answered his own mail, 30, 40, 50 pieces of mail a day. Mm-hmm. He'd read it, he'd answer. So what did this one say?
The writer was very concerned that the fish wasn't actually getting fed. Now remember, she was young. Here's what she wrote. This was in the letter to Mr. Rogers. In quotes, "Please say when you are feeding your fish, because I worry about them. I can't see if you are feeding them, so please say you are feeding them out loud." And it's signed, Katie, age 5.
Out loud?
Yes.
What's that mean?
You see, in the letter, there was another note from Katie's father that said that Katie was blind. And Katie was very worried about the fish and cried when Mr. Rogers didn't say he fed the fish. I mean, much of the audience could see it, but she could only hear it.
Well, that makes sense. So now I'm trying to remember some of the clips I've seen from the show where Mr. Rogers, he's looking off camera. He's got the jar of fish food. He's obviously dropping some flakes into the water. It was obvious to me that he's feeding the fish, but it wasn't obvious to this 5-year-old girl, to Katie, because her vision didn't work, and she was not able to see with her eyes what he was actually doing. I mean, she knew Rogers had a pet fish, but didn't know if it was being fed or not. That's a different perspective.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like that fishbowl activity you were talking about, Dave, when the students are having a discussion and they know how to have an actual conversation, they're going to be exposed, I guess, exposed to ideas different from their own. I'm sure they will likely at some point have a conversation with a classmate who has a different background from their own, a different home environment. And having a different idea is what the activity is all about, isn't it? Especially if the student is able to give, two or three reasons to back up that idea.
That's yet another piece of wisdom from Mr. Rogers. Different perspectives. Like that buddy in the group of guys you talked about who were mimicking or disrespecting Mr. Rogers when he said, maybe you didn't need Mr. Rogers. There are kids who need him.
Let's play a little game here, Dave. A Mr. Rogers kind of game.
Okay.
One built on the words in a conversation.
Okay.
And combined with the development stages of children.
Right, okay? Up my alley.
All right, good. All right. Fred Rogers believed in stating ideas very clearly, right? Since that was a benefit to the children in his audience. Probably a benefit to, adults as well. Less ambiguity, more clarity. So here's something we know as adults. It is dangerous to play in the street.
It is. It is dangerous to play in the street.
Now, Mr. Rogers wouldn't have said that on his show, would he? He would have changed that into a positive statement. Honest, as you say, Dave, and positive.
Okay, well, how about it is good to play where it's safe?
Good. That's better. You would make a good intern on the Mr. Rogers Show, Dave.
Yes.
Now, well, hang on. Now, since we know that children are not able to always determine safety, how would you direct them to an authority figure? You know, an authority figure who would be able to let them know if it's safe or not.
Okay, you're pushing my little limits here, Jeff, but how about ask your parents where it is safe to play?
Okay, good. Another Mr. Rogers principle. Yep. Keep rephrasing. Now, here's the thing. To be fair, the concept of ask could mean different things to different people. You show people how to have a conversation because that is a skill that can be learned and developed. Probably the same with, quote unquote, asking, a skill that may not be learned yet, especially for kids.
Okay, I'll rephrase it. I can be this Mr. Rogers guy.
Okay.
So I'll remove the term ask because, yeah, I can see how that could be vague for a kid. And I'll change it to this. Your parents will tell you where it's safe to play. That's honest. It's direct. It's clear. It uses trusted authority figures to help keep the children safe.
It does, but... Okay, but it doesn't apply universally to all kids, does it? Think about it. Not all children, you know their parents, and that's sad. It's sad. So there will be lots and lots of kids who won't be able to follow your advice of going to their parents because they don't know them. They don't live with them. So, you know, who knows why? But the kids won't be able to do what you suggested. So time to rephrase again, Dave. Well,
this one's actually easy for me because this is a truth we work with in education in schools all the time. Kids might live with their parents. They might live with their aunts, their uncles. They mm-hmm. might live with foster parents, foster brothers, foster sisters. They might live with an older brother, an older sister. I've had kids that live with a neighbor. Kids' home living situations are they're so diverse. So I can rephrase this one easily to, your favorite grown-up can tell you where it's safe to play. It is good to listen to him. You hear that at the end? I beat you. I even add a little motivation
you did.
To help the kids understand why I would want them to listen to their favorite adult, because it's good to listen to your favorite adults.
Dave, that's not like you. But, nice job on the rephrase to your favorite grown-ups instead of parents. But you said, here you go, you said it's good to listen to them. Really? Using a value judgment word like that, Dave.
Oh, man, Jeff, this is harder than I thought, so I'll... Okay, I'm going to try it again. Hang on. Your favorite grown-ups can tell you where it is safe to play. It is important to try to listen to them. And listening is an important part of growing up. There. Did it. No value judgment anymore.
Right. And in quotes, and listening is an important part of growing up. So by adding one last statement like that, it would also allow the child to know that there is a need for grown-ups to keep them safe. And the need to learn how to listen. Those are normal. It's part of growing up. And yet, there's no person in the world like you, and I like you just the way you are.
Oh, thanks, Jeff.
Did you know that Mr. Rogers' legacy still lives on?
What, in reruns?
Well, yes, I suppose that's true, but I was talking about a new spinoff show.
Don Quixote, you mean?
Yes. It's a great show, and it has an excellent play on words. Don Quixote, you know, from the novel. Mm-hmm. And you know what else, Dave? We have a mutual friend working on it.
Is that Zach? Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's camera one. Great guy, skilled media specialist.
He is. Did you know he has his own production company, too?
No, what I heard him talking about it. What is it?
Yeah, it's called Gripco Productions. He does a lot of short videos, branding, marketing, okay. You know, that sort of thing.
Good plug, too, Jeff. Good plug for Gripco Productions. And... Now he works on the set, camera one of Don Quixote, as in a donkey whose name is Hody, Don Quixote.
Yes. Do you remember that character?
No, I got to be honest. No, I don't know Don Quixote.
Well, don't feel bad. The character actually changed from the original Mr. Rogers show to now. Both are very well done, but the character did change. Back then, the character was male, and when he was younger, a younger donkey, he used his large teeth. You know, Dave, how sometimes donkeys are portrayed with large teeth? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Anyway, he would use his teeth to bite others. Well, Mr. Rogers made a lesson for kids out of this.
Of course he did. So what'd he do? How'd he make a lesson?
He created a message for kids that teeth are not for biting people. And so when Don Quixote learned this lesson, he was given a small piece of the rainbow.
Yeah, very creative.
Yeah, it was. And if you watch the new show, you'll see its use of bright rainbow-like colors. It's a very impressive program.
So Don Quixote, the show, where can people watch it?
PBS, of course, and okay. also on YouTube.
Originally, you said Don Quixote was a male character and something's different on the new show.
Oh, yeah, it was revised. Now the creators of the new show made this character of Don Quixote the granddaughter of the original, and that character, that older character, is now called Grampy Hody.
I should say the plots are probably similar to what Mr. Rogers would have wanted.
Yep, you got it. Same age group, 3 to 5 year olds. The show is aimed at helping them with the challenges they face as children, so that's similar to what Mr. Rogers would have mm-hmm. wanted. And the show, which finally started airing back in May, utilizes the talents of you know, so many actors and specialists who are veterans in the children's development world.
That sounds impressive, Jeff, the children's development world. So who are some of the people, who are some of the talents that are on the show?
Well, to start, we have a Muppeteer who has performed the voice of Cookie Monster on Sesame Street, as well as many of the characters on the classic Muppet Show, if you remember that show, Scooter, mm-hmm. Janice, and that character Beaker.
So one of the co-creators voiced Cookie Monster plus those characters from the Muppet Show, and isn't his brother on the show too?
Yes, the brother is bringing his Emmy-winning experience or expertise from Sesame Street, and he was also working on Scooby-Doo and the classic Tom and Jerry. He's bringing all that to the set of Don Quixote.
So, Jeff, you're saying that almost over 50 years after Fred Rogers saved funding for PBS TV, and almost 20 years after the passing of Mr. Fred Rogers, his expertise, his vision, his focus on providing top-notch research-based material for kids, that legacy is still being carried on?
And fun. The programming is research-based, top-notch, and it is fun. So if you have young kids or grandkids, watch Don Quixote with them. You all will probably learn something. So anyway, Dave, good show. Tell us, what's coming up on our next episode?
I don't mean to go negative, but my blood boils over about this. Mr. Rogers was bullied as a kid. It's one of the things I, of course, don't like, but we'll touch on this briefly on the next show, and we'll also talk about the themes of that book, I think. Upstream, how to stop problems before they even begin. And I'm sure we'll talk about so much more. In fact, Jeff, I was told you have a very interesting story to share.
I do. So until next time on Apples to Donuts, take that speech class you've been avoiding. A speech you give may be worth $20 million.